Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us this fine day. I'm, of course, Mike Porky Parry. I'm even more famous than I was when I last spoke to you. I'll tell you all about that in a minute. And, of course, on the other end of the microphone is Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, the rock chick writer extraordinaire. Ms. Jones, how are you?
Very good, Michael. Thank you. All the better for seeing you on national television this week.
Well, I tell you what, it was great to engage with our old pal, Piers Morgan again, OK? And I've told the story many times, but I used to be Piers's boss, you know, when we were in Fleet Street. He was head of the Bizarre column. I was the executive editor. But he ran rings around me. He knew everybody and everything. He brought these five boys into the building and said they're going to be the biggest thing in the world of pop music. And I threw them out because they just looked like a group of dancers. And, of course, it was Take That, you know, including Robbie Williams and Gary, what's his name, Gary Barlow. So it was great. And, of course, Piers is now famous all around the world. I don't think there's anybody on the planet he doesn't know, is there?
He's so connected, isn't he? I mean, he was always going places.
Oh, yes.
Way back in Fleet Street when we were all a bunch of, you know, hacks kicking around.
Yes.
There was always an air about Piers that his eye was on the next prize.
Yes.
Always. So, you know, that was fine for now. Where he was for the moment was doing the job for him.
Yeah.
But every single thing was a stepping stone. Mm. And I so admired his energy.
Yeah. No, I agree with all of that. But when you think about it, every star in the world, you know, he has access to either on Twitter or, you know, he's got their phone number. You know, James Corden, President Trump of America, Joan Collins, you know, most famous footballer in the world who told him he's got great abs. What's his name? Ronaldo, isn't it?
Cristiano Ronaldo.
I've got brain foggy. And so it was great just to do that little show with him this morning. And just to inform our millions of listeners, Peter, that's P-E-T-A or Petta, I'm not sure how they pronounce it.
Yeah, says that I thought it was Peter, actually.
I think it is Peter. I think you're right. They say it's wrong to use animal expressions to illustrate human emotions. So, you know, you shouldn't call somebody chicken if you think they're a coward. You shouldn't call somebody a louse, you know, if you think they're not a nice person, all that kind of stuff, which is utter nonsense, isn't it? Because let's face it, if you call somebody chicken, it's usually on a football field, and you say to your mate, you should have got in there, you chicken. And you're not calling the person a coward. You're saying that, you know, you made the wrong decision, you're flaky or something like that.
Mm. I thought the counter-argument from the lady from Peter, which was that the animals might be offended, was utterly stupid.
What,
because,
nonsense?
You know, the animal has no idea that this is going on. So the only person who's going to, or the only being who's going to be offended by this kind of thing is the person you're calling it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I think I read somewhere animals have about 1.5% the intelligence of the average human being, okay? And we don't even know if they can interpret human voices and sounds. So complete nonsense. But
oh, I think they can. Well, I have two house rabbits, beautiful little bunny rabbits at
really?
Home.
I didn't know that, Miss Jones.
We've had them for some years. We've always had rabbits ever since my youngest daughter was very young. And she's, you know, massively grown up now.
Rabbit.
That yeah, we've always had bunny rabbits. Yeah. And I know that they recognise our voices because when the younger kids were away at university, they'd come home and I'd say, go and say hi to the rabbits. And the rabbits will sit there and sort of cock their head slightly like a budget does.
Yeah.
And they will listen. So I don't think they understand the words, obviously, but I think that they recognize tones of voice. So they recognize my son's voice as opposed to my daughter's voice. They certainly know my voice because they sit very calmly when I go and speak to them.
Oh, they but kept them. Do you keep them in a rabbit hutch?
Yeah, but they have the run of the kitchen, but they have a, it's a very big sort of hutch in the corner by the windows, by the French windows.
Yes.
So that's their home, but they do run around the kitchen. They sit on the sofa and watch TV, that kind of thing. But obviously it's the sounds, it's just general sounds that are soothing to them.
Yeah.
It's not the actual content of the conversation.
Yes. We like to keep this show clean and all that, but what about rabbits' sort of bathroom habits? How do you regulate that?
Well, they're very well trained. You can train a rabbit like a cat.
Really?
To use a litter tray. There's a litter tray in their run, and they go and sit in there and do their thing. Yeah.
Well, I mean, did you train them, or do you have a rabbit trainer?
Yeah, we just would do what you do with a cat, which is to pick it up regularly and put it on the litter tray.
Too much information. Thank you. Right.
Well, you did ask.
Well, I did, yeah. But anyway, that's fine. Now, Ms. Jones, I could have a new career opening up for me. I got up this morning, you know, lots to do and doing a bit of telly and all that and preparing this podcast to do with yourself, which, of course, is the highlight of my week. And all of a sudden, I get a note through saying there is an opportunity for me to sign up as an influencer, right, with an influencer company, and that if I do, I will immediately be given a free gift of an $800 pair of earrings. So somebody has spotted talent in me, which you've never spotted, Miss Jones.
Well, I got the same one, so I think, you know, we're just on... Yeah, I got the same email this morning, so we're just on a hit list, aren't we?
Well, I don't know if we're on a hit. Are you trying to tell me that I don't have then the talent to become an influencer and direct people in the way they should run their lives and encourage them to spend thousands of dollars on merchandise and all that kind of stuff? Are you saying I'm not up to it?
Not at all. I'm just saying I got the same email. So we're obviously, you know, they've looked at our Twitter accounts or our Facebook or whatever. They just pick people randomly, don't they? And anyone stupid enough to sign up for that is, you know, really, come on. Influencers are pointless people. We've seen that with all the irresponsible travel to Dubai and Mexico and those kind of destinations. With as Priti Patel said, there they are showing off in the sun, which is horribly inappropriate during a pandemic when millions of people are dying.
Yeah, you really have shattered my dreams. I thought there was a new career opening up for me there, but obviously not.
Get real, Michael.
Come on. I should get real. Listen, I do want to get real for a minute, right? We don't often get heavily serious on this show, but I'm increasingly becoming concerned about what I'm going to buy in the high street when we get back into normal life, if there's a high street left, because I'm very, very concerned that things that are appearing in the high streets in the Western world here in the UK have been made by people who are actually kept in slavery in China because of their religious beliefs. And I absolutely hate that. I abhor it. I would campaign against that.
Oh, totally. The Uyghur Muslims, I guess you're talking about in China, who are forced into these detention camps, labour camps, a bit like prisoners here. You know, that classic old thing of they would be sewing sacks.
Mail bags,
that kind of thing. But this is obviously much worse because these people are being marginalised. There is enforced sterilisation of their women. They're being murdered, physically tortured, psychologically tortured.
Yeah.
To break the will of an entire group of people is a desperately shameful, evil thing.
Yeah.
And of course we shouldn't be supporting the Chinese regime
on
that account and on many other accounts also. I think we should stop buying goods from China altogether. People say, well, we depend on those little tiny bits and pieces they manufacture for our mobile phones and so on. We'll start making them somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, you know, I agree with all those points. You see, years ago, I'd have said, oh, look, you can't allow the internal workings of a country to influence your relationship with that country because we all live by different standards. So if they cut people's heads off in Saudi Arabia, that for me is never a reason not to sell Saudi Arabia aircraft made in this country. It's part of a massive industry in this
country.
No,
no, no, no.
The defence industry.
Hang on a minute. You think you're turning a blind eye to them chopping people's heads off?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is that if it happens there, it's part of their creed and their culture.
No. There is never an excuse for that kind of thing. That is
I didn't say there was an excuse. I didn't say it was an excuse. I said that's the way they run their country.
Do we have a right to... You said it was part of their culture. It's not part of their culture. We have a moral obligation to protect all people of all creeds, colours, beliefs, whatever, yeah, in the world today.
Yeah, I agree.
That is what Amnesty International is all about.
Yeah, but if we objected to the internal workings of every country in the world, we wouldn't trade with any country in the world. We wouldn't,
no,
because
there are lines to be drawn. I utterly disagree with you.
Well, all I'm saying is the Chinese thing now is so enormous. I mean, you said labour camps. Some of these labour camps are 30,000 people strong. That's the size of, like, you know, a city in this country. It's size of sort of Reading or something like that. You know what I mean? Mm. And it's whole scale slavery. And then you've got to say to yourself, well, what damage will that do to the British economy? And as you quite rightly say, we'll go and find somewhere else to buy it.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
There is no excuse. I am incensed. There is no excuse. We cannot do business in the 21st century with countries who still operate a brutal regime. We can't turn a blind eye to these things anymore.
Well, there's a lot of brutal regimes in the world, you see. I mean,
we have to make examples of them, yeah, and we have to walk away from trading with them.
Yeah. Well, we are very lucky to have been brought up in the most civilized country in the world, and therefore, if we have been, which we have been, our standards are very high. So it's a sort of endless argument, really, about, as you quite rightly say, where you draw the line. Now, Miss Jones, you are a big fan of musicals in theatres, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yes, that's right.
Love a musical, yeah.
Yes, and I'm not that keen on musicals. One of my good friends, I'm delighted to say, is Mr. Bill Kenwright, chairman of Everton Football Club and the world's biggest theatre impresario. He invites me to a lot of first nights. He specialises in musicals. I'm not a terribly good theatre person, but Bill always throws a terrific party afterwards at a top hotel or on a boat on the Thames, and that's why I go. It's not just why I go, of course. You think I'm a bit mercenary, don't you?
Yeah, you go for a free drink anywhere. Oh,
that's very nice. Anyway, the reason I ask you is because there's just been a survey of the top 20 records from the top musicals. And number one is One Day More, Les Miserables. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's a fantastic song. Yes, of course it is. And I think Les Mis have held the number one and the number two slot.
Bring Him Home, number two.
Which is probably the most moving musical theatre song you can imagine.
Is it?
I've had my son was in Les Mis, in a student production of Les Mis, and yeah, he played Jean Valjean and sang those two songs.
Oh, really?
It's so, so incredibly moving. It brings tears to my eyes even thinking about it.
And did you watched him in the live performance?
Oh, yeah.
Golly, that must have been terrific for you. As a mother, seeing your son on stage singing those emotional songs, that must have been wonderful for you.
He nailed it. He really did. The whole theatre gave him a standing ovation. It was wonderful.
I bet they did. So at number eight, here's one of my favourites. Don't cry for me, Argentina.
So I think Tim Rice had two. He had number seven and number eight because Circle of Life, which he wrote with Elton John,
really?
Was also another one of his. Yeah.
Oh, golly, I didn't know that.
So he's got two in the top ten. He'll be very happy about that.
He'll be very happy indeed. And the other one that I love, and I'm not sure if I've got the right song, is Midnight and the pavements are empty. Is that Memory?
Not quite the lyric, but it is Memory, yes, which came from Cats.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's all great. So what I'm saying is I don't really want to sit through a three-hour musical to listen to those great songs. I'd rather have them on a CD. But there you are.
Here's a word of advice.
Yeah.
I wouldn't tell Mr. Kenwright any of this because Mr. Musicals doesn't really want to hang around with people who don't like musicals.
I'm just saying. But don't worry, Mr. Kenwright's aware of a lot of my excesses and has always forgiven me over the years. If there's been an occasion where maybe, a glass of wine too many in the boardroom has happened, Mr. Kenwright is very understanding of my emotional turmoil if Everton have had a bad result. Now, Miss Jones, I have, I'm sure, seen pictures of you. And by the way, your pictures in our publicity material is getting a lot of attention at the moment. People do seem to be very fond of you, Miss Jones. I hope you're pleased about that.
I had a really funny email over the weekend.
Oh, yes.
Was it an email or was it a text? I can't remember. Maybe it's a private Twitter message.
Yeah.
I was in a TV show on Friday night on Channel 5, which was talking about the top songs of the 1970s.
Brilliant.
And this chap wrote to me. He said, there was this program on about, you know, the top songs of the 70s, yeah. And there was a woman on it with the same name as you. Was that your grandmother?
Yeah.
Because I suppose he's looking at me on screen as I am today, and he's looking at the retro pictures that we're using on Twitter, which we're only using for a laugh, by the way. And he's thinking, well, that girl's got the same name as that woman, but it's not the same person. And he's saying, is that your grandmother? Which I thought was hilarious.
Well, that's a load of nonsense. They're not retro pictures. They're fairly contemporary. And you don't have enough confidence in your own image, Miss Jones. I can tell anybody who's listening now, millions of subscribers to Planet Porky, millions of listeners to our radio and TV shows, that the look that we portray in the blurb material for Life on Planet Porky is very close to the real thing. I can vouch for that.
You're very kind. You look at me through rose-tinted specs.
Next time, you know, we get to live back in the real world and we go out in our Fleet Street pub crawl and we get into a restaurant somewhere in London, believe me, I'll be delighted to have you alongside me. Talking about that, by the way, I saw some survey of the world's best pubs related to the literati. And it was a story about the fact that in Oxford, a pub has closed. It's called the Lamb and Flag. Don't we use a pub in Covent Garden called the Lamb and Flag?
Yeah, we do. Just on that, it's by that Inigo Jones restaurant, isn't it? Just up that little passage up there.
Yes.
Opposite where the Garrick is.
Yes, that's right. Opposite where the Garrick
is. It's a very, very old pub, and we've had some good lunches in there.
Yeah, we have, yeah. It's got a nice restaurant upstairs and that kind of stuff. But anyway, this is in Oxford. It says, the Lamb and Flag was never outwardly the most attractive pub in Oxford, sitting on the long tree-lined St Giles Street between the Ashmolean and Pitt River Museums, both very famous landmarks in Oxford, and it could easily be overlooked. But to those in the know, it was the writer's pub, the cosy, understated, ever so slightly musty haunt of everyone from C.S. Lewis to Philip Larkin. It was, as drinking dens go, rather a magical one, and one of its most famous patrons ever was Dylan Thomas, right? But it's closed down because pubs are struggling to survive.
It's
such a terrible shame. And so they listed all the, you know, the great pubs which you can relate to great literary characters. And the second most famous one is Ye Old Cheshire Cheese, London. Located on Fleet Street, the exquisite 17th century pub has drawn in numerous famous figures. That is where you and I hope to be heading for, Miss Jones, once life is back to normal.
I had a christening party in there for my youngest daughter.
Really?
Yes, we had the baptism, obviously, at St Bride's Church across the road.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then everybody piled over to the Cheshire Cheese. They've got a big basement, sort of a reception room. Do you remember that? Yeah, and that's where we had the christening party, and we had a buffet and everything else. It was funny because Frank Warren is one of my daughter's godfathers, the boxing promoter. And he rocked up in his Rolls Royce. His chauffeur couldn't find a place to park on Fleet Street because it's all double yellow lines and so on. And who
was this again?
This is Frank Warren.
I know. Yeah.
And it was shortly after Frank was shot.
Oh, right.
If you remember, somebody took a pot shot at him and he survived, although he was grazed on the back of the neck by the bullet and rushed to hospital, and they discovered a tumour at the top of his spine.
Wow.
How lucky was he? They would never have discovered it had he not been shot and had they not had to operate. So they were able to remove the tumour. So anyway, he was very lucky because of that.
Yes.
But there was Frank in the church with his bodyguards, and there was a titter going around the congregation as if to say, who are these people that they rock up with godparents that have to have bodyguards?
Bodyguards, that's absolutely right. And of course, that was such a famous story because the allegation always was, but never proven, that the person who fired the gun was either a boxer who felt he'd been sort of cheated out of some sort of a contract. Who we won't name, or a representative of that boxer. And it was an amazing case because it was almost like a TV drama, wasn't it? You know, boxing promoter, an up-and-coming boxer, fallout, contract is torn up. What happens next? Boxing promoter sitting in his Rolls Royce. Person runs past in a tracksuit with a hoodie. A shot is fired. And, it was very dramatic, wasn't it?
You're never going to get to do the bottom of that kind of thing. Nor should we, I think. We don't stray into that kind of territory, do we?
Yeah. I mean, you're also talking here about a man who was hung out of a window by Mike Tyson, literally a hotel bedroom window 14 floors up, when Mike Tyson thought he was getting done over by a contract. I mean, they have very colourful lives, these boxing promoters.
It's a bit like the music business, isn't it? I mean, that kind of thing did go on. I remember the stories about Don Arden, Sharon Arden's father.
Yes.
Terrible stories, similar.
Was he Led Zeppelin?
No, you're thinking of Peter Grant.
I am. You're absolutely right, yeah.
Don Arden was involved with so many artists. So many people I came across over the years claimed that they were the artist who was dangled out of a window. It was almost a badge of honour, you know. He was a very cruel man. He once set his dogs on his own daughter, Sharon, and caused her to suffer a miscarriage.
Good God, what a terrible story. I think we'll move on from that one, Miss Jones. Family show, you know, and all that. Anyway, just to get back to the old Chest Cheese for one moment, it says Charles Dickens was sufficiently impressed by it to have Charles Darnay enjoy a good plain dinner and good wine on the premises in A Tale of Two Cities. So I didn't realise it had become, a great, location for a Dickens novel. When Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot visited, he had the steak and kidney pudding. I tell you what, I don't particularly like the Cheshire Cheese because it's just a collection of little rooms with high ceilings. And I never get the feeling that you can comfortably settle down there with friends.
I sometimes go there for a drink with the rector of St Bride's.
Oh,
it's
good.
Just across the road from where she lives.
Is this Alison?
Yes, but you're right. It is just a little collection of sort of snugs, isn't it? Yeah. And you can never get a seat in there. It's always packed.
Absolutely.
In normal times, anyway.
Absolutely. When I sometimes do television in Gray's Inn Road, I always get my car, not to take me home to Surrey, because I hate being in a car for an hour. I get them to take me just across town to Fleet Street, because I think, well, if I'm in London, and we don't very often get into that part of town anymore, I think I'll have a look in a couple of hostelries because the television finishes at 11:15 and the booze is usually open at 11:30, right? So I get over there and I go to the Bell, which is just lovely. I love the Bell. You know it better as well as I do with the, you know, because it obviously backs onto St. Bride's Church. And I have a plate of sausages and a couple of pints of beer, which is absolutely lovely, you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes I go to the Cheshire Cheese just because it is the Cheshire Cheese. And they do a beautiful pork pie. So if I haven't had my sausages, I'll go to the Cheshire Cheese and have my pork pie. So it is very high in my list of things that I'm glad I've ever done in my life.
This is a good story about the old Bell, actually, or ye old Bell.
Yeah.
Do you know the reason why it was built?
No, but I'm sure you're going to tell me, and I'd love to hear, please.
Sir Christopher Wren built it to house his builders who created St. Bride's Church.
Right.
So this was the inn in which they lived while they were building the church.
Fantastic story. The church, of course, and we've told our listeners about this before, the spire of that church was what they modelled the modern day wedding cake on.
Absolutely.
And isn't that absolutely fantastic?
The tears, yeah. It is.
Absolutely.
And it was bombed to smithereens during the Second World War, but the spire survived.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely amazing. I was in which town is it in Germany? It's got a Cologne. Right, I was in Cologne. And I was there during the World Cup in 2006. England were playing there. And the only thing in Cologne that never came down during the 1,000 bomber night raids by the RAF were the two magnificent spires of Cologne Cathedral. And think about St. Paul's Cathedral. In that part of London, the East End, it was the only building that wasn't demolished by German bombers. I mean, do you really think God is looking down upon this planet and saying they are protected?
It's very interesting, isn't it? You know, when the 9/11 terrorist attack happened in New York.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've been down to Ground Zero since.
Yes, I have, yeah.
I've been down a few times, and there was, among all that rubble and wreckage and destroyed buildings, a tiny little church that's been there since the 17th century, and that survived. And there was the cross sort of rising from the wreckage.
Yes.
And they used that church, in fact, to sadly lay out the bodies people they found in the rubble, and also the firemen and the emergency services were using it as a base, that little church, which I visited some years afterwards. And it is amazing how churches will so very often survive great disasters.
Yeah, even in Coventry. I mean, Coventry Cathedral got bombed, but, you know, the skeleton of the church is still there. Because they were so well built in the sort of 14th, 15th century, you know, the bit of them got blown away, but the rest of it didn't. But anyway, the power of the Almighty. Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in here to Life on Planet Porky. Miss Jones, of course, being as irascible as ever. We got to talking, Miss Jones, about, you know, your image, your pictures and all that. And the reason I was gone on to that was because I've come across this piece which says, Specs Cheat Alert. Glasses wearers are the biggest love rats. Now, I'm pretty sure I have seen pictures of you in glasses in which I would vouch that you are trying to improve the sexiness of your image. Am I right?
Well, they used to say, didn't they, men only make passes at girls who wear glasses.
Yeah. No, I think they used to say men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses, or the other way around?
Oh, I can't remember. But I mean, isn't it more to do with the fact that after about the age of 30, most people have to wear glasses or at least contact lenses because of changes in our vision and so on. Yeah. So I think this is a bit of a non-story, really.
Mm. Well, it says here 3/4 of people who have affairs wear glasses. How about that, eh? The percentage of spectacle wearers who stray was found to be higher than the percentage of glasses wearers amongst the general population. Maybe people who wear glasses can see better, so they recognise a tasty member of the opposite sex or the same sex because they're wearing glasses and short-sighted people can't spot it. Maybe it's that.
I think it's utter rubbish, because if you think of all the people you know,
the
vast majority of them wear glasses. It's just something that happens to us as we age. And if you think about when most people have affairs, so a lot of men, I'm not saying all, but a lot of men reach their midlife crisis in their 40s and start to look at their wife, who they may have been married to for maybe even 20 years in some cases, and start to think there's something better out there. I'm going to go off exploring. Or they get into a tangle with their secretary at the office, you know, that classic old cliche. I think it just happens to be that it happens around middle age, which is the natural age at which most people start wearing glasses.
Yeah, well, it could well be right. The old idea of glasses for squares has also been quashed. I didn't wear glasses till I was about 24, even though I was getting short-sighted, because I thought it would turn me off from being attractive to women, honestly. Because in those days, glasses had thick black sort of rims, you know what I mean? And it was definitely for nerds, glasses. So I delayed wearing them for a long, long time. Now, of course, you can get such fantastic designer glasses. Mind you, they're very expensive. My last pair of glasses, I think I told you, cost me £675.
Oh, yeah. But you're very lucky, because I had to wear glasses from about the age of 8. And
right.
I was known as Joe 90 at school.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Because I had thick black-rimmed glasses, yeah, which my mother thought were very trendy in those days. Oh, wow. I didn't have National Health glasses, which were those little round sort of pink-rimmed things. I didn't have those.
Yeah.
But in all my pictures from my childhood, I feel that my face is blighted by the presence of these horrible big glasses.
Really?
So I was always very self-conscious.
Okay.
I got contact lenses when I was 16, and that changed my life.
Really? Mm. Golly. Well, there you go. I've never tried contact lenses. I read so many horror stories about people going to bed when they were drunk. And I was always drunk in those sort of days, in the 20s and the 30s. And I thought, I'll burn my eyeballs out. So I never got them. But, I mean, people get, you'd read these horror stories that the contact lens would get welded to your eyeball and all this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, you've got to remember to take them out. But I mean, back in those days, they were hard discs of plastic.
Right.
And you had to take them out. You had to rinse them in saline solution. You had to soak them in another chemical so that they didn't grow bacteria, so that you would then endanger your eyesight by putting them back in.
Yeah.
But nowadays, they tend to be daily disposables. So you stick them in, and you take them out and chuck them away and wear a different pair the next day. So that's much more simple. They're also very soft material now, so they're much easier to wear.
I don't want to try them, and I'd never let a laser beam go in my eye either.
No, definitely not.
My mate Andy Townsend had his eyes done by laser. I said, are you mad? He said, it's got, you know, 100% success rate. I said, it hasn't. It's got about a 99.999 recurring success rate, but I still read stories of people whose eyesight has been destroyed by laser beams. A laser beam in your eye. Can't believe
it. No, definitely not. What they don't tell you is that it's not a one-off thing. So it's not as if you go in and have this laser surgery and that's it. You've got perfect eyesight for the rest of your life.
Yes.
Because your eye continues to change as you age.
Yes.
So you do need to keep having it recorrected.
I didn't realise
so that's
that.
Yes, it's a lifelong commitment.
Oh, no.
My father had treatment for his macular degeneration, and he had some horrible various kind of laser surgical procedures, which were very painful. Wow. And he was lucky to get them because it extended his eyesight for the rest of his life. But there's no way I could go through something like that.
Oh, God, neither me. Now, talking about that, by the way, I see there's been a huge uptake in people buying DIY dentistry treatment kits. Now, I can hardly believe this, but I've actually seen them on sale in Boots, which is one of the few high street stores which is still open and available to everybody because it sells medicines and all that kind of stuff. I mean, can you imagine? Oh, I've got a bit of toothache. Go and getting a DIY dentistry treatment kit and trying to treat yourself.
No, this is a very dangerous thing. I think people are setting themselves up for long-term complications, including, you know, problems with your jaw. You can develop an abnormal bite if you only eat on one side of your mouth.
I don't like an abnormal bite, Miss Jones, I can tell you.
Well, no, absolutely not. And it is a family show. But you can also get gum disease, tooth decay. You can even get tooth loss. So I think, you know, people might say, well, dentistry is far too expensive at the moment. But in cases of real hardship, you can still get treatment through the NHS, especially emergency dental treatment.
Well,
so I would urge everybody to keep seeing their dentist.
Oh, so would I. Do you know what? I did a programme recently. I can't remember who it was with or what it was for, but it was actually sponsored by one of these companies who make these repair kits, DIY dental repair kits. I mean, I've never heard anything so ridiculous in my life. It goes right back to the old idea of tying a bit of string around your tooth and slamming the door.
Oh, God.
You know, and all that. Anyway, look, you know, family
my
show.
My mother
family
used
show.
To do that to us when we were children. If a tooth was wobbly, you know, if it was about to come out, but it was... When they wobbled, they were painful, weren't they? Little teeth, baby teeth.
No, milk teeth. No, I don't think they were. I used to actually pull them out. I used to wiggle it around until it felt okay.
Yeah.
And then pull it out because I needed the sixpence under my pillow that night.
Yeah, my mum used to tie a string around it and tie it to the door handle and slam the door. We had that.
No, you're joking.
Yes, I think it's abuse.
How on earth can you tie string around a tooth when there's teeth on either side of it?
Yeah, well, she did.
Good God, that's terrible. I'm really sorry, Miss Jones. I didn't realise you'd been subjected to such terrors in your childhood.
I wish I didn't remember that. I want to forget that one.
Forget that one, definitely. Now, are you a prawn eater?
Yes.
Right. Well, you've got a problem because it says Britain is facing a post-Brexit prawn crisis. Large UK tariffs on fish caught around Greenland have seen prices soar. Greenland is diverting supplies to Europe, leaving a shortage for shops and sandwich makers in this country. Is that bad news for you, Miss Jones?
Well, it's not particularly bad news, is it? There's always something else to eat. It's not like I'm going to die if I don't have prawns.
Well, that's a very good point. When I see these ridiculous stories about, oh, golly, there could be a shortage of blueberries now in Tesco's. All right, we'll buy blackberries or buy raspberries. You know what I mean?
Well, all of which are out of season at the moment. I'm a great believer in eating fruit and vegetables which are in season.
Right.
And that we can grow here. So we shouldn't be eating strawberries in January, February. We should be waiting for our own strawberry crops to come alive in July and August, for example.
So I don't
believe in flying in strawberries from Israel so that we can have them during the winter.
Why not? That's called world trade. And they've got better weather,
right? Nice. They're not as nice. They don't taste as sweet.
Well, I saw some programme actually on this last night. Apparently, we import 100,000 tonnes of apples from Australia.
That's mad. We grow apples here.
Yeah, but we don't grow them in the winter, as the point you've just made. We can't harvest apples in the winter here, can we?
No, I suppose not.
So we have to get them from Australia. Look,
why are we getting them from so far away?
Well, because they freeze them and put them in huge containers. And so, you know, it's very cheap to ship them over. The programme I saw said that food now is cheaper than it's ever been in the history of the world. Did you know that?
Well, I didn't. But why would that be? I would, if anything, have expected it to be more expensive.
No. It's because production methods are now so sophisticated that they can, you know, in the days when... Take Cider with Rosie, right? So in those days when that book was written, people used to have to go into orchards and pick the apples by hand. Well, now they just send a machine in. And so it makes it a lot cheaper, doesn't it?
But they wasted an awful lot of cider apples this last summer because the demand for cider had gone way down because the pubs were closed.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that's happened right across the board. The prawns that I like, I only like prawns in one place, right? And that is in a prawn cocktail in an Indian restaurant. How about that?
You have a prawn cocktail in an Indian restaurant?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
Yes, that's my starter. You know, everybody else has like an onion bhaji, you know, or some, you know, something like that or whatever. I won't go to an Indian restaurant unless it's got a prawn cocktail starter, seriously. And I love the prawns and I love what's the sauce they put prawns in?
Mary Rose sauces. I have a fantastic recipe for that, and I've made it for years.
Yeah, and some lettuce, and I love it. Honestly, it's great. I really do.
Oh, now I know what to make you when you come round for dinner.
Then. Well, absolutely. As long as the starter's in place, absolutely no problem at all. Now, wokedom is taking over the world, Miss Jones. What about this? An anti-woke citizens advice service has been inundated with requests since it launched. Counterweight, it's called, founded by a lady called Helen Pluckrose, an author, to combat what she sees as a rising tide of positive discrimination in the name of social justice. And she said, we're very proud of the work we've been able to do. For example, we've had charity workers get in touch who were concerned funds were being diverted from helping vulnerable people to being used for undisclosed diversity training. Are you a warrior against wokedom, Miss Jones?
I do think it's all gone too far. As with everything, you know, something starts, it's a trend, it's a craze, it's a fancy, it's the latest thing. And of course, it always goes too far. I heard that at Island Records at the moment, that any position that becomes vacant has to be filled by a person of colour, regardless of talent and suitability for the job. Right. Now, that is taking wokedom too far, isn't it?
Yes, I believe in diversity, but the diversity I believe in is that you open the doors to any body who wants to apply for the job. You look at any candidate, you take consideration of anybody who has the confidence to nominate themselves for the job. And then when you've looked at everybody who's done that, you weigh up who's the most suitable and talented person to do that job. And it's almost as if the interview should take place behind a screen So you don't know what colour they are. You don't know, you know, what nationality they are or what religion they are. You just want the best person for the job.
Well, you do in theory, but you see, a lot of people's names will give the game away, won't they?
So, but they could be like candidate A, you see what I mean? Candidate
well, that's
B,
true.
Candidate C, you know, that's what I'm thinking.
That's true. I don't think that we can carry on this positive discrimination thing the way it's operating at the moment, because it is actually discriminating against other groups of people who are being marginalized in the name of wokedom.
Yeah. No, I kind of totally agree. And that one goes around in circles. Now, Miss Jones, I've got to make an admission. I'm in love again. How about that, hey? You know, I've entered early middle age and all of a sudden I've been smitten again. And the woman of my desires at the moment is the latest Bond girl that we haven't even seen yet, but she's in Die Another Day, which is the Bond film that looks like it'll never get released at this rate. It keeps being pushed back. But her name is Ana de Armas. And she is of Cuban descent, and she is the female star of the next Bond film. That woman, to me, is a goddess. She's everything.
That's interesting, because I read an interview with Tanya Roberts. Do you remember her?
Yes.
She played Stacey Sutton in A View to a Kill, which was, can you believe it, 1985.
That Good God.
That was Roger Moore's last Bond.
Right.
She'd been in Charlie's Angels before that, and she said that being a Bond girl had trivialized her career and prevented her from getting other lead roles. She said she was young when she accepted the role. She didn't know any better. Yeah. She went for it, and then her career bit the dust. And I began to think about other Bond females who'd come and gone over time, the ones I could think of. Yeah. Ursula Andress. I mean, you know, whatever happened to her? I found that she was in one Elvis film. Was it called Fun in Acapulco or something?
Probably something like that. Do you know, you're absolutely right. Ursula Andress made such an impact in Dr. No for that, you know, incredibly famous cinematic shot of her coming out of the water in the Bahamas with holding a shell and wearing a white bikini. And you're absolutely right. That's what made her famous. But I can't remember her being in any other film ever.
No, she was in that one with Elvis, and that was about it. It does seem to be the kiss of death, because you had, okay, for example, Daniela Bianchi. She was in Russia with Love.
Yes.
She never did anything else after that. She married a shipping tycoon.
Right.
Honor Blackman, who was Pussy Galore in Goldfinger.
Yes. Yeah.
She was in The Avengers, but that was only on TV.
Yeah.
And then she had a bit part in Bridget Jones's Diary.
Mm.
And that was kind of it. She's died now.
Yeah. No,
Jane Seymour. Jane Seymour, Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
We know she was in a few television things, wasn't she?
But the doctor or so, the female doctor or so, woman doctor.
Medicine woman,
Medicine woman, that's right, yeah.
But that was on telly. That was not a sort of feature film. Barbara Bach married Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
You know, so a Bond girl, it is a bit of a kiss of death, I think. It's the ultimate in sexism, isn't it? Because they are there to be sex symbols.
Yes.
So it's a bit old-fashioned an idea nowadays. Mm.
Yeah.
And I suppose we have to move on from it.
Yeah. What is it about Cuban girls? Who's the other beautiful Cuban woman I'm thinking about? Is it J-Lo? Is she Cuban?
Well, Gloria Estefan
is
famously Cuban.
Yes.
She's a very gorgeous woman, even in her 60s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very sultry, exotic kind of look, isn't it? Because it's sort of Hispanic.
Yeah.
It's sort of Caribbean. There's an American edge to it because it's only 9 miles off the coast of Florida there, isn't it?
That's right.
Cuba.
Yeah.
It is a good look, I have to say.
Oh, they're beautiful. The most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life was in Argentina. I'm not joking. Just the most stunningly beautiful women in the world. And you have to say, the blokes are pretty good looking as well. You know what I mean? But it's a country of incredibly good looking people. And I remember walking through a park in the centre of Buenos Aires. And, yeah, it was one of those beautiful afternoons. Got quite a nice climate, Buenos Aires, because, of course, it's in the southern hemisphere, you know. And all these couples lying around on the grass, entwined with each other. It's a very romantic sort of place, Argentina. And they also do the old tango dancing, you know.
Oh, the Argentine tango is very sexy dance, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. You know, the sort of the passion and the intensity and, you know, two people so close to each other. And I think that's, you know, getting pretty close to what I regard as, you know, ultimate sexy sort of attraction, if you see what I mean.
Although Would you go so far as to learn the tango to find the woman of your dreams?
No, definitely not. I'd make a complete and utter oaf of myself, you know, as most people do on Strictly Come Dancing. Now, Miss Jones, I want to talk to you about a story where I think a bin man has been done down. Did you read the story about this bin man and he's doing the bins? And I have to say, I've got a lot of respect for bin men all the way through the old lockdown and the pandemic and all that. My bins have been getting emptied and I'm very grateful for that. My one fear is having rubbish piled up, you know, at the side of the house or the back of the house or in the forecourt or something like that, because it's horrendous and it attracts vermin and all that. So this bin man, and there's been a bit of snow around. The kids have built a snowman in the front garden. The bin man's trying to get the bin in and out. The snowman's in the way, so he karate kicks it. And then when he comes back, because he's knocked its head off, he gives it a few karate chops. The snow had gone, and the snowman was, you know, sort of deteriorating anyway. And he got the sack when the family complained. I think that's ridiculous.
Well, look, I agree that it's ridiculous to fire him. It was going to melt anyway.
Yeah.
But I think we have to be sensitive to the fact that the child had made that snowman very lovingly. He'd be very proud of his achievement.
Yeah.
And it can be very crushing to a little kid if somebody ridicules your painting or your plasticine model. Mm-hmm. We know today, don't we, that we have to be a good deal more sensitive to children's feelings than we were in the past. So I think seeing it from the child's point of view, he made that and then some big oafy bin man comes along and kicks it to bits.
Yeah,
I can see both sides.
Well, yeah, you say that, yeah, but I do admire these bin men. I mean, they do a great job. I wouldn't want to be a bin man, to be honest. It's not like I remember when I was a kid and the bin men came. They came in one of those lorries where there were two sliding doors on the back on each side, and they used to literally pick up the bin, put it on their shoulder, go out and tip the contents of your bin into the back of their truck, you know. Not like that these days, of course, and hopefully not. Now, Miss Jones, we can't leave the podcast without referring to the Beatles. We've got through 44 minutes without talking about the Beatles, but I think it was 52 years ago, last Saturday, that the Beatles got on the roof of Applecore in Savile Row in London and played the famous Last Concert. And everybody knows about that, but I read an amazing story by our old colleague, Christopher Wilson. Do you remember Christopher?
Yes, I do.
He was a very handsome chap, wasn't he?
Pass.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Ooh, I might have to reinvestigate that one, Miss Jones, if you've had some sort of a problem there, you know. But anyway, I knew Christopher. I think at one time, Christopher was William Hickey, wasn't he?
Yes, a little bit before my time.
A bit before your time. Okay, we'll leave it at that. But anyway, he wrote the story and he got the pictures out and he revealed that a chap called Ken Wharf, and Ken Wharf is now pretty famous as having been Diana, Princess Diana's last bodyguard, okay? And
yes.
He was the bloke who, you know, looked after her and sometimes she'd put her head on his shoulder when the marriage was crumbling and all that kind of stuff. And in this picture on the roof of Applecore, there's a policeman, you know, in a typical policeman's helmet from the late 60s, and it's Ken Wharf as a copper. And I thought it was fantastic, the contrast between, you know, that day he spent on the roof of Applecore watching the Beatles perform for the last time ever together and his subsequent life where he was bodyguard to the most famous woman in the world.
Well, that story's been around for years, of
course.
Well,
it has, I suppose.
We've long known that, yes. But yeah. Because there was a cop shop just down the road, the Mayfair sort of central police station, which is where he was stationed at the time.
Yeah. Really?
That's where he came from, yeah. I know two people who were personally there on that day, one of whom was on the roof and one of whom stood in the street below because the sound apparently was much better. So Keith Ultham, a famous PR man, represented the Rolling Stones, Mark Bolan, Paul McCartney, who's The Who, worked with everybody. He was up on the roof that day and witnessed the concert at point blank range.
Yeah.
And I wrote about him in my book about John Lennon because Keith had dashed out of the office when he got the call to say the Beatles are performing on the roof.
Yeah.
Get on down there. He hadn't picked up his coat. Of course, it was freezing cold. It was in the middle of winter.
Yeah, it was January.
Yeah, John Lennon, when they were finishing the concert, was coming away. And he used to refer to this guy as Fab's Keith because he worked for Fab 208 magazine in its heyday.
Right.
And he said, "Are you cold there, Fab's Keith?" And Keith said, "Yeah." And he says, "Do you want my fur coat?" Which was actually Yoko's fur coat.
Yeah.
And Keith said, "Oh, yes, please." And John said, "Well, you're not having it," and walked away, which was the classic John Lennon remark, wasn't
it? I was going to say, the cruelty of John Lennon, indeed, yeah.
The other guy was Mike Batt, the famous composer and songwriter, who was a 19-year-old A&R man at the time.
Wow.
And he stood down in the street listening to this famous last concert.
Yeah.
And he said he's never forgotten it.
Yeah, well, I shouldn't think he would. Do you know, years later, I got to know Steve Lillywhite, the, you know, legendary producer of U2's The Joshua Tree and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, married to your friend,
Kirsty McCall.
Kirsty McCall, that's right, yeah. And he said that the, do you remember the U2 went and did it on the roof in Los Angeles, Streets with No Names or something? Right. He said it was just a direct ripoff of what the Beatles did. And that's
quite honestly, every bit of music since has been a direct ripoff of what the Beatles did.
Yeah, it has. No, I totally agree. So there we are. Right. Okay, Miss Jones. Well, thank you very much indeed for having joined me today. You know, another week in paradise, as they might say, because we're all in lockdown and don't see any signs of it lifting yet. But we just have to get on with life. So I say to you, Miss Jones, please take care. I say to our millions of listeners, please stay safe and also take care. And we will be back with you very soon.
We will.
So at number 8, here's one of my favourites. Don't cry for me, Argentina.
So I think Tim Rice had two. He had number 7 and number 8 because Circle of Life, which he wrote with Elton John,
really?
Was also another one of his. Yeah.
Oh, golly, I didn't know that.
So he's got two in the top 10. He'll be very happy about that.
He'll be very happy indeed. And the other one that I love, and I'm not sure if I've got the right song, is Midnight. And the pavements are empty. Is that Memory?
Not quite the lyric, but it is Memory, yes, which came from Cats.
Oh, right, yeah, okay, that's right, yeah. Yeah, well, anyway, that's all great. So what I'm saying is I don't really want to sit through a three-hour musical to listen to those great songs. I'd rather have them on a CD. But there you are.
Here's a word of advice.
Yeah.
I wouldn't tell Mr. Conroy any of this because Mr. Musicals doesn't really want to hang around with people who don't like musicals.
I'm just saying. The sort of the passion and the intensity and, you know, two people so close to each other. And I think that's, you know, getting pretty close to what I regard as, you know, ultimate sexy sort of attraction, if you see what I mean.
Although Would you go so far as to learn the tango to find the woman of your dreams?
No, definitely not. I'd make a complete and utter oaf of myself. Did you train them or do you have a rabbit trainer?
Yeah, we just would do what you do with a cat, which is to pick it up regularly and put it on the litter tray.
Thank you. Right.
Well, no, you did ask.
Yeah, well, I did, yeah. But anyway, that's fine.